You're listening to the cycling podcast of the 2024 Tour de France with Mitch Docker, Richard Abraham, and Graham Wingos. Today we're in Colombey les Deux Églises.
Jonas, quick one for you. Who's going to win today?
Magnus Kort.
Magnus Kort, love it. Good luck today.
Just one quick question, Biniam. How do you see today playing out? Do you think it'll be a sprint or a breakaway?
I think 50-50 from what I see, you know, because I don't think a lot of teams want to control the race. Okay, we are here, maybe Alpecin. I don't think Lotto will do. Also, Trek Pedersen is not there. So, yeah, I think it's a 50-50 chance.
Who's going to win today?
I think it'll be a sprint.
It's a sprint. Okay, so pick one.
Yeah. It's not Dylan then.
Easy. Nilsson, quick one before you go. Who's going to win today? Yeah.
Somebody from the breakaway. It's impossible to predict, I think, right
now. You have to pick one.
Nielsen Palace.
If you have to pick anyone apart from you.
No, man. I got to go all in on myself.
Back yourself.
I'm backing me, bro.
Good luck today, mate. Who's going to win today? It's lumpy. It's wet.
Yeah. It could be from a breakaway. It could be from the bunch.
If you had to pick one?
I'd say it must be about time that Alpecin, they get it together, and Philipsen, he wins it.
Do you think it's a question of who needs one today? Who needs it the most?
Yeah, I guess that they, you know, they're still empty-handed here, right? And they do have the strongest team for this kind of stage. Could also be Van der Poel himself.
Sure. But yeah. Do you think Van der Poel might have one eye on tomorrow, the gravel stage?
Yeah, but today is also a good opportunity. Like, you know, it could even be from a breakaway.
Yeah.
But interesting, at least.
Really interesting. At least,
you know, for once there's an interesting stage, I'll say.
Oh, well, I don't know.
They won't sit up in the breakaway
in
today.
Of course, yeah, exactly. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Enjoy today.
Today, sprint day or breakaway day?
I hope sprint. Yeah. I don't think anybody can beat Arnaud on this final kilometer.
Do you think he's got enough to get over the climbs of today?
I'm sure. But if a breakaway with 8-10 rider go, it can be that it's a breakaway stage. We will see.
Finally, who is the most dangerous rider, do you think, for the breakaway? Who have you thought has got good legs and good form in this year's tour, maybe threatening?
He didn't really show it yet, but Matej Mohoric is very smart. And when a good break goes, he will be there.
Mikhail, who's going to win today? One for you?
Oh, who knows? With the rain.
Fabio, who's going to win today? One question, if I may.
Ooh. We'll see at the finish line. I don't gamble.
You don't gamble? Not like, if you had to pick someone, it's a lumpy day, it's a rainy
myself.
Day.
Myself.
You're backing yourself, of
yes.
course. If it's not you, who
That's
else?
Why I'm here.
Who else?
Nils Eekhoff.
Thank you. Good luck today, mate.
Why are you here? I'm thinking, on paper I thought a sprint, but even the team sports directors are like, oh, it could go either way. If it stays dry, sprint. I'd like to see Cav go again.
Is it the sort of day for Cav, or is it the sort of day that Alpecin might think, we need something today, we need to drag Philipsen to the front, get him his win when maybe one or two other teams don't fancy it?
Head says good chance for Pedersen. Heart says Groenewegen or Cav.
You know Pedersen's not starting today.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, it's not going to be him. That's right. Yeah, let's do
it. It's a good pick, though. I had him down until I heard he wasn't starting.
It's exactly the sort of data to him.
Philipsen.
If it's like this tomorrow, do you think we'll see one or two riders doing a Cadel Evans and cleaning their mech with their water bottles? On the gravel, I mean.
I don't think it's going to rain, but I hope not, because it sounds like the entrance to the first sector there might take out half the peloton.
I think if it's wet anyway, they're not going to know that trick, because they haven't been on the mountain. They haven't been on the fat tyres, have they?
Yeah, probably not.
That's right. It's a little marginal gain. Cadel, thank you.
Boys, the riders and pundits that we heard, that we asked this morning in the paddock at the race start to play us in there, let's just go through them. From front to back, Jonas Abrahamsson, Biniam Girmay, Luke Durbridge, Nielsen Paulus, Michael Rasmussen, Victor Campenaerts, Michael Kwiatkowski, Fabio Jakobsen and Cadel Evans. Mitch, first of all, good to see Cadel.
Cuddles, yeah, great. He was in good form. Good to see. Always great to have a chat with a Tour de France winner.
Richard, remind me who you spoke to this morning very briefly.
Briefly, just before they rolled out, I got a little grab with the man of the moment again, Biniam Girmay in the green jersey. He was putting on or taking off a green gilet overcoat thing because it was absolutely tipping it down this morning in Semur-en-Auxois. But that's two wins.
Two wins for Biniam Girmay. Two wins for Intermarché Wanty. And Girmay winning in green today, out-sprinting Jasper Philipsen, Alpecin de Koenigs, Jasper Philipsen, and Arnaud Delis, Lotto Destiny, on the ramp to the line. The Eritrean has now won in the green jersey, as we say, to extend his lead in the points classification. He said afterwards that his first one was good, but he picked his moment, sailed through to cross the line first there. This one, he really had to grind it out, Mitch, didn't he? Because it was a proper slugfest. We saw it, in fact, on the drive in, just how much the course ramped up to the line.
Well, it was a straight run too, so it was hard to gauge with that hill, with the straight line. There wasn't a corner or any markers like that. And looked from the front, from the TV, watching it, looked like Cofidis had done a great job with Brian Cockard, but he was way too early. At 250 metres to go when he hit out, I don't even know where he finished, way back somewhere, but he hit out way too early, and it was a long drag. They didn't start their sprint. Biniam didn't start his sprint till 100 metres to go, and you could see from there it seemed to take forever. It was a real grind and a real strongman sprint. It was a tough day, actually.
It was a tough day from start to finish. It was a long day out, Richard.
It was, and we should explain where we are. The sun is trying to peep out now, finally get a bit of warmth on our skin. We're in Colombelles des Églises, which is a bit of a nowhere place, really, very, very small, and it's sort of a hilltop, not town, village. We're actually in this Charles de Gaulle Memorial Centre, and the view behind, well, actually I'm not looking at it, I'm looking at the centre itself, but Graham, you've got the great view behind me, overlooking fields and forest, rolling countryside of this deep part of France. It's beautiful here, isn't it? It's
proper Tour de France territory
now. I absolutely love today's stage, even though nobody would talk to me because it was raining, except for Biniam. Today was just classic middle of the Tour de France. Not quite sure what day it is, where you are, but it's just, you know, you're on the tour. And my point, I guess, about where we are, this sort of hilltop place, it's where Charles de Gaulle is buried, French statesman. And well, we saw that in the sprint, didn't we? It was rolling all the way here throughout the day, and then a bit of a fast run in into the final few kilometers, and then it just went up almost in kind of steps, a little bit steep, a little bit flat, a little bit steep, a little bit flat, and then the final bit, a little bit steep. And quite a few riders got caught out by that because they went a little bit too early. And I think what really worked in Girmay and Philipsen's favour today is that they held off really late until the last 100 metres or so, didn't they? That slow motion sprint. We're not talking more than like 4 or 5%, right? But for these guys, that makes a big difference.
Yeah, well, and today, as you pointed out there, rolling hills, they were French. It was a real typical French. If I have to describe to someone what it's like racing in France, I'd describe today. Those climbs that sort of just, it's not a climb, but it's not a hill. It's something in between that's on all day, over and over again. And those roads that aren't too small, but aren't too wide. And look, I think something that's changed over the years is that the peloton these days, and this is something that Luke Durbridge told me is, and I realized it too, watching, is in the old days, you know, even not so long ago when I was racing, is that when the peloton was in one line, it was going fast. And when it was bunched up, it was going slow. Now what's happening is when the peloton's bunched up, it means they're going fast because everyone is pushing towards the front. And when they're one line across the front, that doesn't mean they're going slow. They're going 50, 55 k an hour. When they're actually in one line, they're actually cruising now. They're all just relaxed. They're all just riding in, you know, tempo. It's so strange to think like that. You've got to turn your brain around because it looks like they're all cruising along. But when it's one box on the road like that, it is stressful. And that was today.
Girmay now equals Robbie Hunter's record of 3 Grand Tour stage wins by an African rider. Shall we hear from the man of the hour?
To be honest, I never think about my victory.
never, even from the past, win Giro and Gent-Wevelgem. I think I never think. I'm just thinking for the future, because if you win one stage, the next day, if you lose, just people, they think they only see the last one. So I'm just always trying to improve, to do things better, and then try to win more and more. But I've never seen my previous victory, and then I've never just give myself, I win this, so maybe I'm good. But I'm just trying to enjoy, to relax, because if you win, it's already now, it's already past. So yeah, it's over. So I'm just trying to enjoy every single moment.
So to round out the tale of the Etape, boys, Jonas Abrahamsen, Uno X Mobility, the man in the polka dot jersey, took 7 KOM points today to extend his lead in the climbers competition. He punched out early. He took Stefan Bissiger and Nelson Paulus with him for EF Education Easy Post, but they soon sat up, went back to the bunch. It was a long old day out on the front for Abrahamsen, Rich. He was caught with just 14 kilometres to go, and then
it came down to the bunch finish, didn't it? But he got the most combative rider award, and well, that's kind of his job now, is just hoover up these little ones and twos that are on the third and fourth cats over the next few days into the second week, and just see what happens. And you know,
until he loses it all on one climb.
Exactly. Whoever's first over the first climb. Well, is it the Tourmalet? Correct me if I'm wrong, but the first Pyrenean climb, I think off the top of my head, is the Col de Tourmalet, at which point someone will get, I don't know, 20 points, and that'll be that. But it was fun while that lasted. And it lasted a long time, isn't it?
And can still last a long time. Exactly. Because the Tourmalet is a long way away.
Yeah. So, yeah. Well done, Jonas.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Thank you to MAP, the Cycling Podcast clothing partner, for supporting the podcast. This is Lionel here. And I'd like to say that MAP's support is one of the big reasons that we're able to continue with our daily on-the-ground coverage of the Grand Tours. So a big thank you to MAP. Check out their beautiful clothing at map.cc. Last night, Friday night, was the first round of the MAP London Summercross at Herne Hill Velodrome. You must know by now that cyclocross is not just for winter, it's a year-round sport, and Summercross has been going for a few years now, and there are 3 more events over the course of the month. The Herne Hill Velodrome in southeast London is steeped in cycling history, and if you've not been before, the MAP London Summercross is a great opportunity to visit. There'll be the racing, of course, food and drink and entertainment, and it all kicks off at 5:30 p.m. on the next 3 Friday evenings. That's July the 12th, 19th and 26th. If you want to enter the racing yourself, go to the British Cycling website and search for MAP London Summercross. Good luck! A quick reminder that the 1101 Cappuccino email went out to subscribers on Substack yesterday. Richard Abraham and I both offered our perspective on Mark Cavendish. Richard wrote about win number 35, which came along earlier this week. And I talked about an episode of Kilometre Zero I made in 2021 called Don't Mention the Record, which was a series of my own memories of covering the incredible Mark Cavendish story over the years. There's a link to that episode in the email if you'd like to listen to it. And if you want to read online or sign up to receive the 1101 Cappuccino updates directly to your inbox, you can do so by going to thecyclingpodcast.substack.com. 2 weeks today, on Saturday, July the 20th, I'll be at the West Lothian Cycle Circuit in Linlithgow in Scotland, which is not far from Edinburgh, or not far from Glasgow for that matter. I'll be there for the unveiling of a plaque to commemorate and celebrate our dear friend and co-founder of the cycling podcast, Richard Moore. The plaque has been created by friend of the podcast, Stacey Snyder, in clay and then cast in bronze, and it will be unveiled by world record-breaking cyclist Mark Beaumont. The circuit will be open from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. The plaque will be unveiled at around 11 a.m. Bring your bike if you can and ride a few laps with us. And if you can't bring your bike, just pop along for a cup of post 11 a.m. cappuccino. We hope to see lots of listeners there if you can make it. I believe there's also some plans to watch the tour stage somewhere in the afternoon, but more details on that as I get it. Now back to Richard, Mitch and Graham over there in France. I have actually set them a bit of a challenge as they arrive in Troyes. They've got 2 nights in Troyes, and I've said that there'll be a special prize for anyone who manages to eat the local specialty tripe sausage andouillette 2 nights running. I want photographic evidence that the andouillette has been eaten and not shared amongst the 3 of them. 1 man, 1 andouillette, that's the rules. But if they're up to the challenge, good luck to them. Anyway, back to them over in France. Enjoy the rest of the weekend's racing.
Kevin, tell me about the final kilometre there. It was, you guys were all in control. Tell me about the final kilometre and leading in for that amazing win.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Like, I wasn't part of it anymore, so I did my work until 6K to go, but then I saw, I was lucky to be, that my following car was behind me, so I could watch everything. So they probably looked like they were completely in control, and also the whole day, one guy, but he was really strong in the front. We had to push quite hard to get him back, but it's unbelievable that he wins again. And yeah, like this kind of finish lines, I think he's the best rider in the world at this kind of finishes. So yeah, he proves it again today.
It looks like he's going to have a very strong hold on the green jersey now with some really tough sprints to come. That suit, it looks like it really suits Beanie.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And also, you never have to say, like, tomorrow I think he can also do a good result. Like, it's also a race that suits him. And I think as a team, we have to ride again for him. Like, this kind of finishes, I think, like tomorrow also, he's a classic rider. So I think it's also something that suits him. And then we go with a good feeling in the rest day.
Unbelievable feeling coming into the rest day, like you said, and teams on top of the world.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Like, we first won the first stage, the first sprint here. We won also with Biniam, and then today again. So it's two sprints and two sprints wins already in the pocket, and two victories for the team also. So yeah, we didn't win the last year, so it's really impressive to start like this in my first tour.
So we played in there on Gerben Tyson. Mitch, you went off in search of the Intermarché Wanty bus. What do they have to say? Smiles all round?
Yeah, I didn't actually get down to the bus. I was up in the finish line hanging out, and they're all hanging out up there. And that's, look, often at the finish line, a lot of riders on such a day, grimy, wet, cold, hard day, they just push through. And that's what all the riders did, except for the Intermarché Wanty boys. They were just all hanging about doing interviews, which was great. And you could see they were really absorbing it. Naturally, two stage wins. And it was really cool to sort of witness that. And I just had to wait my turn because the two guys I was waiting on, Rex and then, you know, Gerben, they're both Belgians, so they were both at Sporza and that sort of thing, and waited my turn. And then, you know, Gerben, he was able to come over to me, and it was good to chat to him because he was quite excited.
It's great when riders have got time for you like that. And they're clearly relishing it.
Yeah, and look, I think now their focus is they're all excited. They've all got a clear job, and they're, you know, it's long term with Biniam Gamay because he's signed on for the team for another 3 years, I think. And you know, it's a project they want to continue on. They've got a great rider there. Look, I'm saying all obvious stuff, but now the green jersey is a real focus. I think he's got a real handle on that because it's only going to suit him as this race gets harder and longer. And you know, he's not an all-out sort of flat sprinter. These sort of stages, like tomorrow's stage, he can pick up another point later on in the mountain days where there's a prem over a mountain per se. And again, at the end of this, he's going to be creating history once again if he can get this jersey, the first black African to win the green jersey.
Rich, you went off in the other direction.
Yeah, I just want to say, actually, before we leave Intermarché and Biniam Gamay, he's got a real something about him, Biniam, a certain star quality, but not in the kind of loud or, you know, smiley. I mean, let's think about some of the other stars in this year's race. Van der Poel, quite reserved and kind of lets his legs do the talking. Pogacar, smiley, ebullient, effusive. Biniam is quite quiet. He's very well spoken, but he's got this sort of charisma about him in the way that he carries himself. And it's just interesting to note that, you know, if I had him on my team, I'd be delighted. Mm. Just someone that you know, kind of naturally would want to focus around, but in quite a, not a macho or a bullish way. I've been really impressed by that.
Yeah, I remember speaking to Dion Smith last year, and he was just saying he's just so cool to ride for.
So Dion rode for Intermarché, right?
Yeah. At the Tour de France, and we're talking about, you know, what it's like as a teammate, and I was trying to get an interview with him. He said, yeah, go for it. He's great. You know, he's really cruisy. But also he said he's just a great leader within the team as well. And we've seen that here. You know, the pressure, there is pressure around what he's doing, but you don't feel that around him, do you?
You really get the feeling that his team want to ride for him, not because it's their job, but because they really want to back him up. They've got a great deal of respect and fondness for him. It's not just the fact that they are paid to do it. I thought he said something quite interesting afterwards. He was asked in the press conference why there have been no, because obviously I'm going to take you back to yesterday evening when we were talking about whether or not it would be a sprint stage today or whether it would be one for the break. And we more or less settled on it being one for the break, given given the way the course was set out. And he said, look, every single team are gunning it on the front for the sprint. I'm paraphrasing here. But it's a product of there being so many sprint teams here that the breakaway just, and today is a brilliant example, just didn't get a look in.
Yeah, and it was really hard in the beginning too. And over the mid climbs there, you know, I overheard Fred Wright saying how hard this stage was. And he is a rider who notoriously gets over a few lumps. You know, that suits him, a stage like today. And overhearing his interview was, look, I at the moment there when it eased up, I just had to take 50K at the back just to try and get rid of some of the lactic out of my legs before it ramped up at the end. We saw EF really trying to make it hard there at the end with Ben Healy to suit their sprinter towards the end there. So it was a tough day, even though it maybe didn't look like that. Looking at the faces of the riders, I was talking to Jens Voigt, who was out there on the motorbike, and he said it was a really, really tough day. These riders, and again with that bunch, like I was saying, stressful day. These are the days that people, I think, watching it on TV, myself included, not being in the peloton anymore, you underestimate how much these days take out of the riders. And then suddenly they're supposed to flip it tomorrow and hit the gravel day after just a standard sort of day today.
And I think to bring us back to your original question, Graham, at the finish, I went to the Alpecin de Koenig bus, and the first person I could grab was Sylvain Dillier, who is the kind of the tractor, he's the Tim de Klerk of Alpecin de Koenig, the guy that they put on the front to control things, keep the brake in check, keep everything like in a nice sort of comfortable position, and then hand over to the faster boys at the end when they can lead out for Jasper Philipsen. And well, we'll hear what you had to say, really. But one thing that I was quite curious to ask about is, like, well, what's going on with the control in this race? Because it seems like no one team has got absolute control over a sort of stage that could end in a sprint like today. So let's hear from Sylvain, shall we?
Please tell me about the day today, how you felt the stage went.
I think it was a strange day. In the end, pretty hard still. For the whole bunch, because the parkour was always up and down, twisty roads, and in general, we didn't felt super good. But we still tried. At the end, it didn't turn out with a victory.
Are you finding it difficult this tour to control the race in the way that you would like to?
It's just really unpredictable. You never know what's going to happen. First you think a big breakaway could go, then all of a sudden it's only three guys, which eventually end up a few kilometers later with only one guy up the road, and then he has 7 minutes, and then we have to go full gas to catch him back anyways again. So it's always expect the unexpected.
Why is that? Is it because the teams are just not communicating or working well together? What's going on?
It's a Tour de France.
Another second place for Jasper on a finish that didn't really look like it would suit him with the climb there. So, you know, he's getting close, but still not quite able to get the victory.
The thing is, to win races, it's always super hard. But if you're a couple times second or really close, it proves that he's not far, and the team does a good job in setting him up well. So I think we just have to stick together, be confident, and one day we will take the victory again.
How will you find that missing 1%?
You know, there is always a small part of luck involved in everything. So far, maybe we missed this little bit of luck. We had the first sprint stage a little bit misfortune with the crash and the flat tire of Mathieu, And yeah, so one day it will be in our advantage again.
So Richard, you spoke to more than one rider from Alpecin-De Koninck today. We spent a little bit of time talking about what's not going quite right for their main man, haven't we?
Yeah, they are, to contrast, you know, what we've just said about Intermarché Wanty, the vibe outside Alpecin-De Koninck is not entirely positive. It wasn't as angry and as sort of smashy as it was the other day when Philipsen was effing and jeffing and shouting on the bus. But he's not in a great mood, and I don't think, well, Christoph Rodhoeft as well, the team boss, came out and had a chat with the press. He's not in a great mood either. You know, they're sort of, they're nearly there, aren't they? But they're so nearly missing something.
Finished second twice, Philipsen, been disqualified once for deviating from his sprint line and impeding Wout van Aert.
Yeah, and I'm not sure whether they need a little bit of luck or whether the confidence is lacking as well. But it's a great example of how important the kind of mood is in a team. And let's contrast it with Intermarché. They're in a great place. Guermaier's got two stages and they're just like smiles all round. Alpecin are under a lot of pressure, and that, I think, is reflected in what it's like to go and speak to them and just hang around that bus and hang around that team. But it's also slightly reflected in the way that they're riding as well. But let's have a little listen to Philipsen, shall we?
Well, Jasper, you picked the right wheel. You're on Binyam Kamai's wheel in the perfect place to launch. Did you make any mistakes today? Anything you do differently?
Not that I know. I think in the end, it was a pretty tough finish. And I didn't feel great today, so I was a bit surprised I was still second. But I think it's a finish that Kamai also suits very well. So, deserved winner.
Just describe your frame of mind with all these second places. I mean, how frustrated are you?
Yeah, I think we just need to get it right, and we need to have small adjustments, and then the win will come also.
And, well, maybe it's the confidence is the main thing that is difficult to sort of find when you're on a run like this.
Yeah, but we'll turn. If we can be second, we can win as well. And once we have a bit better luck, then we're on the move.
Mitch, the other rider that we were thinking about running the interview from earlier this morning with was the man you had a magnificent tash off with, Magnus Cort.
Yeah.
Just because we thought today suited him to a T. As it turned out, it wasn't one for him. But apart from the fact that there were several gendarmes surrounding you for your own safety when you and Magnus got together, tell us a little bit about what went on there.
Well, I just want to have a quick word to him, because like he said, I thought this was a textbook stage for Magnus Cort Nielsen, either in a breakaway or either the sprint. And even though I did just say before how hard this stage was, maybe it wasn't hard enough for a Magnus style rider, somewhere where a climb really, not stress, I think today was a hard day because it was stressful and it was sort of hard climbs but never hard enough to drop sprinters. It's a combination of things. I think Magnus needed really just a stage that had a couple decent sort of 5-6k climbs in it that thinned the bunch right out, and then a sprint. So unfortunately he didn't get up there, so that interview with him was sort of useless. But more or less, he's someone I'm actually surprised he hasn't done something yet. And, you know, maybe he's not quite on the form that I thought. And I did put the pressure on him this morning and said, hey, this is Magnus Cort Nielsen's stage. He goes, yeah, it is, isn't it? And, you know, he's very dry. And whether he's just sort of trying to put me off the scent, I'm not sure. But what's going on there? But Christoph was up there again. Good signs for him. Once again, that team sort of really just exceeding their position in this race.
It was a brilliant picture, I think. Who was responsible for putting it up on the Cycling Podcast social media?
That would be me. That'd guilty be as charged. There's a lot of guilt going around, as we will come to.
Shallow depth of field. Beautiful picture where the two moustaches sort of locked eyes, so to speak, for the first time in this year's tour.
The brushing of two moustaches.
Well, get across to the, you know, the cycling podcast and give them a follow.
At the start today also was Mads Pedersen, but he was a DNS, Richard. The injuries he sustained, in particular his scapula going down in the sprint on stage 5, meant that he was unable to continue and start the race today.
Yeah, I saw him roll along through the lanes just after the finish of the time trial yesterday, and he did not look a happy bunny. And then we saw him wandering down to do a little bit of media interviews this morning. He looked delighted, didn't he? Mitch, you ran alongside him, got a few words in. What did he have to say?
Yeah, it was great. I was just grabbed him. I didn't expect to be able to chat with him. Look, typically, Mass is quite hard to interview. He's very hard to get on the mic. So he was surprisingly quite upbeat. And I said to him, you're in a surprisingly good mood. And I think it was just for me, after hearing around the bus and also talking to Maxim Montfort, you know, the sports director there, he said when Mass sort of came to that decision yesterday, when they all came to that decision, he said you could see this sigh of relief wash over him. This, obviously, the Tour de France stress of just being here to get a result, that was building up. The crash, what do I do? And this indecision, this pain, all this stuff, and then just the decision getting made, knowing he can just go, cool, I can stop this and move on, and he is focused for the Olympics. That was the first thing that came out of his mouth. I'm stopping here today because I'm going to win the Olympics. And he said it with real sort of real, like, it made me want to go out to the bookies and go, right, that's it, let's get it down now. And yeah, he did a really good interview. He was in a real positive mood despite everything. It was clear that he'd moved on and he's ready to make a new decision and move on from the race.
Yeah, interesting how a rider can switch like that, and they kind of just need that certainty sometimes.
Yeah, and like 12 hours before that, say, different scenario. But he's had the night to settle, got his thoughts together, and he was ready to take on the media today in a real positive way.
Yeah, process it. Some desperately sad news from the Tour of Austria today. Andre Drege was involved in a fatal accident at today's race. We're sending all our love to his Coupe Repsol team, his friends, and of course, his family.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
South Carolina's got everything. Natural beauty, trendy cities, but you might miss your next big adventure in a smaller town. We've got you covered on the Palmetto Porch. Discover South Carolina's official podcast. I'm Devin Whitmire. Come with me as I venture off the beaten path and learn about these towns from the locals who know them best. Check out the Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information, head on over to scpalmettoporch.com.
Chaps, a story that we didn't cover yesterday, just because, I mean, for a time trial stage, so much happened, and there were so many storylines coming out of that. But one of them was that Julien Bernard, the Little Trek rider, was fined by the UCI for what he rightly called a magic moment. But he stopped on the climb in the middle of the time trial yesterday to kiss his wife and 2-year-old child on his home roads in Burgundy. Richard, I don't know if you want to sort of paint a picture of the scene before we get into it and before we hear from Julien Bernard, but I mean, it was absolutely joyous, and so many fans on the roadside, so many of his friends and family had come out.
Well, if you're a rider listening to this, if you ride a bike, you probably will have imagined yourself in the Tour de France at some point. Imagine you're doing the tour, your home race, the biggest race in the world, and it goes through your home roads. And not only that, all of your friends and family have come out with loads of signs that say your name. And
to top it off, your wife and your small child are there. You're doing the time trial. The person behind you is like a minute behind you, and you've got this opportunity. You're riding through a tunnel of fans. Everyone's going ballistic for you. And of course you're going to get swept away in the moment. Now, I think Julien, I think the facts of it are that he sort of knew that was going to be there on the climb of the time trial, and so sort of anticipated that. But it was a really highly emotional moment, and a beautiful one as well to see in the tour. Like, it's such a nice storyline that complements the pointy end of the race. We were all there at the finish thinking, well, what's Vingegaard going to do? What's Roglic going to do? What's Remco going to do? What's Pogacar going to do? And then you have this is a whole other aspect of the tour, like what it means for a rider who's just a domestique on Little Trek. I say just a domestique. I mean, probably one of the best domestiques in the world by virtue of being here. But it was, I actually missed it on the day, but then I saw it overnight. I saw some of the video clips, and it's absolutely wonderful, isn't it? And then you see that the UCI has fined him 200 Swiss francs.
On what charge?
On what charge?
do you want me to tell you? Because I've got the wording here.
Have you got the exact wording?
Have
you got the exact rule?
Because I do.
The rule had lots of numbers and dots, and as if that would make any sense to anybody.
It's one to really get into.
On what charge?
I mean, this is Democracy Manifest. Julien Bernard has breached Article 2.12.007-8.6.
Oh,
which,
is it 8.6, is it? I didn't
that
know
one,
I
that. It always gets you, you see.
The old 0.6, eh?
Unseemly or inappropriate behaviour during the race and damage to the image of the sport. Now then, before we hear from him, or shall we hear from him first? And then we'll talk about the image of the sport, shall we? Let's hear from our man, because Mitch, you caught up with him earlier.
Julien, tell me about yesterday in the time trial. What happened?
I think it was a crazy moment. Since November, I knew the tour will pass really, really close to my home. And this is my training road for 15 years now. So it was a special moment. And when I get my selection about 10 days before the tour, I was with my friend before to leave. And I say, imagine I can pass a really, really good moment on this climb. And I think my wife and my friend, they took this personal, and they organized a really, really nice moment for me. I didn't really know what was coming, but I know something special was there. And I'm not disappointed. Actually, it was a fucking good moment.
Can you understand what you got a fine for, putting the race in disrepute or whatever it is? But, like, I don't quite see it like that, because there was, you know, hundreds of fans up there for you. I counted, you stopped for about 4 seconds. What do you think about this fine from the UCI?
I have nothing, not a lot of things to say about that, you know. Like, I prefer we speak about this magic moment and not about this fine. I think the commissaire, they just did the job. And I accept yesterday when I came to the table with the guy, I just say, okay, guys, sorry, I take the fine for me, I will pay. I don't want anybody else pay for me. But everybody want to share the fine, of course, on the table. And they say, no, we all share this together. And, it's difficult because you always get this fine on the paper without nobody came in your face and tell you what's wrong. Actually, I didn't think about this when I stopped. I just think about have this good moment, and this fine was coming, and I receive I don't know how many message of people supporting or who want to pay in this fine for me or everything, but it was super crazy. And I say I will say to the commissaire, I just accept the fine and I will pay, and end of the story, and we don't speak about this anymore.
So Mitch, I'm going to bring you back in on where we left off before we heard from Julien. It's that line that I think has really stuck in the craw for most of us: damage to the image of the sport. Because as far as the image of the sport goes, those scenes of wife, child, best friends, ecstasy on the climb, everyone absolutely delighted to see him. That image on sort of rolling, sunny French roads, isn't that exactly what we want?
It humanizes the sport, doesn't it? You know, it takes the roboticness out of, you know, sometimes what we've seen as. With these big sunglasses on, helmets, skin suits, no one really knowing who we are or anything. It's such a hard sport to follow for people who, for instance, are only tuning into the Tour de France once a year and don't know the riders outside of that, the Tour de France, and don't follow them that hard. Suddenly, they're seeing these riders, and this is what these extra clips are doing, with the teams are trying to do, is trying to humanize them, understand the characters of the sport, make it more attractive for people to watch. And scenes like this, it allows people to sort of relate to what's going on and relate to the support around these riders and what it means to them, the sacrifice they're putting into it. And to be slapped with that kind of fine, you know, and I was actually right there when the UCI came over and had a conversation with Julian, also with Maxime Monfort, the sports director, and also with Stephen De Jong, the head sports director. And I was able to sort of eavesdrop on that conversation.
In another place that you weren't supposed to be, 2 days on the trot.
Yeah. Well, I'm always pushing the limits, aren't I? That's what I'm on. That's what I'm employed for. And, you know, actually, those guys, the UCI were trying to argue their side of the point, but they were sort of just a little bit caught out. And Julian, the thing that Julian pointed out was, hey, look, you've actually posted on your social media an image of me going up the climb. You're using this to promote the sport. You know, take that down. If this is the point, you need to remove that right now.
Hypocrisy manifest, Richard.
It's just a little bit confused here. They want to sort of say that the thing I got out of that conversation was, look, we don't want riders stopping left, right and centre, giving kisses to to their wives and whoever else is on the course, and we need to make sort of an example of something. Not those exact words were said, but that was sort of the gist of the conversation. But it's sort of going against... why are they using this sanction, you know, putting the sport in a disrepute? It's actually doing the opposite.
Yeah, and a friend of mine in the UK has just, in the last half hour, sent me a BBC News article. So, much more widely read and consumed than any kind of specialist cycling media. The headline, Cyclist Fined for Kissing Wife During Tour de France. So...
is this all part of the plan? Have we been caught out? Have we been suckered into the trap? Well, that we're now talking about it, the BBC are talking about it.
In one sense, it's the fact that the UCI has fined Julien Bernard has kind of made the story what it is. And if I were to read that, it seems like cycling is, it's almost like not being taken seriously as a sport, you know? It's like the news story isn't talking about Tadej Pogacar, isn't talking about Remco Evenepoel, right? Winning the stage yesterday. It's not being taken and digested as a sport. It's like, huh, look at this funny thing that happened. And that wouldn't have happened if the UCI hadn't fined him.
It does seem, it often seems, in their sort of meeting out of fines, totally arbitrary. I'll give you an example. Magnus Cort, who we mentioned earlier, stopped on the Galibier to give his partner a kiss. And he posted on social media earlier today, Thank goodness they didn't catch me.
I dodged the ball. You know? Yeah, well, yeah. It's a common practice. If riders are going through, you know, a lot of French riders, eventually that goes through their hometown on a road race, and you see them either attack in front of the peloton, have a bit of time, stop on the side, say hi to their family, join the peloton again, or, you know, stop and then catch back up. No sanctions are ever being, you know, given.
Also, 200 Swiss francs is...
200 chuffs.
Chuffs. 200 chuffs. Here we go. The BBC has... happily done the calculation for me. That's $223 or £174. I'd pay that to kiss my wife or child on my home roads with all my mates around me.
He got two for the price of one. So
they don't fine per individual kiss, do they?
It goes into the Christmas party fund, doesn't it?
It goes into the skiing holidays wine fund.
I don't want to say that definitively about the UCI.
This is entirely speculation.
I mean, who are we to say that the UCI compiles the fines and spends them all on wine? That would be purely speculation.
Let's hurry on from that particular point. Mitch, we spoke to Francois Thomazou earlier as well, a friend of the podcast. He called it the same thing that you did, which was...
He said, oh, it's bullshit. That's my best Francois impersonation. And I think the listeners know that's a common occurrence from Francois. When he believes it, he says what he believes. And yeah, he wrapped it up much better than we have. It was good to hear from him and just sort of put that across to him, because he's got that perspective that in one hand, you know, they're saying that it's putting the sport in disrepute, but on the other hand, actually it's not really doing that at all. We're showing, like I've already said, you know, another side to the sportsman and another side to the sport.
Being as we're all less than chuffed about this, as Richard rolls his eyes, can I suggest that we start fining each other for various faux pas?
But the fine can be in French francs. Can we find old each other school, in French francs?
Yeah.
The currency is even
find
more.
Each other in beers. Or pints of wine.
What will we think? Pints of wine. Pronunciation fines definitely would incur a little penalty.
Yeah, I thought that might come up. But points for trying on this?
No, not the French. But as we've been rightly corrected with Jorgensen.
Yeah.
The hard J being the correct one.
Mass. And nice. Mads Pedersen, which we've already done in this episode, actually.
And really kind of house style, as to, you know, as tempting as it is to say Cav, you know.
Mark
really
Cavendish.
To be Mark Cavendish. I don't know what else we would... I jinxed it earlier because I said we've actually been pretty good, haven't we? We haven't lost anything. We don't have to go back to collect something from a hotel.
Fines for... leaving pizza boxes on the roof. That was the big one. Victimless crimes, Richard. Yes. Mitch, what are you saying?
I'm trying to think of stuff, because I'm pretty good with all that stuff. I'm pretty fine. I'm perfect.
Yeah.
weren't you talking about having done souvenirs in reverse on the tour last year? You would leave something in every hotel.
Well,
room.
Speaking of Mr. Thomazou, he actually, because he left the tour after Leviscos last year, and I left my wash bag in the hotel before Leviscos, and Francois, he went back and grabbed it for me and shipped it out to me by the end of the tour.
Proper gentleman, isn't he?
Yeah.
Speaking of Francois, he kindly sent us a few words on the illustrious rider and director sportif, Raphael Gimignani, after the news that the great man has passed away at 99 years old. The tour paid its respects to Gimignani ahead of stage 8 this morning. As a rider, he was a brilliant climber. He won 7 stages of the tour. He took the KOM jersey in 1951. He also came second in that Tour de France. Richard, he was a massive character, wasn't he? And he was most famous for, or arguably most famous for, latterly, setting up
the team that became known as San Rafael, incredibly influential in kind of cycling culture for, well, latterly, for anybody who's worn a Rafa jersey or piece of clothing. I had a poster of Gimignani on my bedroom wall, because I'd been to France when I was a teenager and I'd picked up an old copy of Miroir des Sports from some time in the 50s, and it was him and Coppi was there, Jean Robic, a few others, and Gimignani was like the front cover. So I stuck it on my wall, like, you know, it's kind of sepia old-fashioned thing. And I remember vividly this kind of long-limbed, really expressive face, but with kind of slick back gel hair, being this, he was my image of the Tour de France in years gone by. But I thought, well, my first thought when I read the news that that Raphael had passed away yesterday on stage 7, well, not, he wasn't on the race, but on the same day, was, well, I'll go and find somebody at the start village. And then I thought, well, let's just let Francois speak and put it into perspective, just who he was.
Hi guys, and dear listeners, as Chiro would say, I really didn't expect to have my voice on the cycling podcast this year on the tour. I only planned to come on the tour for the individual time trial, yesterday's individual time trial, not for the cycling, but because of the place names, Chevrey-Chambertin, Nuit Saint-Georges, that rang like, you know, music to my ears and to my palate, as, you know, strongholds of the best Burgundy wines. But then we heard that Raphaël Gemignani died, and it's one of those larger than life characters of French cycling. There are a couple of others like René Vietto or Raymond Poulidor, and someone said that Raphaël Gemignani, of all the French guys who should have won the Tour and didn't, like Poulidor, Vietto, or Thibaut Pinot, or Romain Bardet, the one who really would have deserved to win it was Raphaël Gemignani. And, well, if you've read the obituaries, you know all about his cycling career. He was the son of a cyclist, actually, an Italian cyclist who fled Italy in the 1920s to find a better life and in France, and then he was called the big gun by Louison Bobet. He was a very faithful teammate of Louison Bobet, and the big gun was because he was swashbuckling. He was this kind of aggressive, attacking riders that would, shoot, kind of a rifle in the way you attacked, sometimes senselessly, just for the sake of it. And he nearly made it a couple of times. He came second in the Tour in 1951, was the best climber in the Giro in 1952, and was really well known for his attacking style. You knew that with Raphaël Gemignani, there was a show going on. He was aggressive, he was spectacular, he was a kind of a mixture of Julien Alaphilippe and Thibaut Pinot, and with also this kind of beautiful loser approach to cycling. Never calculating anything. And the closest he came to winning the Tour was in 1958. He was an aging rider, and there was an up and coming rider called Jacques Anquetil, and Gemignani, because he was a troublemaker, was not even called up by the French team. He was relegated to a provincial team in the Tour de France that year, and in the 2 days before the end of the Tour, he had won the Tour. He was in the lead. He was in the yellow jersey. He should have won it. And then, oddly enough or not, the whole of the French team at the time, right before Anquetil, made sure Gemignani didn't win the Tour de France. He should have won. The very striking thing about Gemignani, and he says a lot about, he finished third in the end, about the man he was, that he had no hard feelings or no regrets or nothing. He stopped his career in 1960, and then became a sports director, and he became the sports director of Jacques Anquetil, the man who had beaten him into third place in 1958. He was a real good advisor for Anquetil. I mean, he was in charge of Anquetil's team for the last three of Anquetil's five Tour de France wins. The most famous, episode about Gemignani and Anquetil was in the Porta d'Envalira in Andorra, when Anquetil was on the verge of giving up, because the day before they both got drunk on the rest day and had too much to eat, and Gemignani told him, well, if you want to give up from the front, don't give up from the back. And that day, in the descent of the Porta d'Envalira, Anquetil attacked and finally won the stage, hungover. I guess hangover is something Raphaël Gemignani knew pretty well as well, because he belonged to that category of riders who was also a bon viveur, as you say in English, because in French we say bon vivant. I didn't know Raphaël Gemignani that well, but I knew him. I mean, we met quite a few times in my early career as a sports journalist. And the thing I knew about Gem, as we call him, was that if you were in a town that you didn't know, and you were looking for the best restaurant in town, well, you went to the place where Gemignani went. Because after his cycling career, after his sports director career, he started a career as a bon viveur, as a professional bon viveur. He was actually professional bon viveur. He was from Clermont-Ferrand, and at the end of his life, and for the after his cycling life, he became covered king of the night of Clermont-Ferrand. He owned a couple of discos and clubs in downtown Clermont-Ferrand, and a few restaurants. he was the life of the party, and he was on the tour until the mid 90s, I think. And there was also a famous spot in the Tour de France in the 80s that was kilometer 92. It was a place on the stage, you know, at kilometer 92 there was a buffet with wine, cassoulet, you know, all the local specialties, and you were sure when you were going to kilometer 92 that you would find Raphaël Gemignani there with his, you know, old friend Fred De Bruyne. They were both covering the tour in a big Mercedes, and obviously the aim of the game was not to follow the race, but more to follow the advice of the Michelin guide. Anyway, I didn't see Gemignani much in his, you know, towards the end of his life, but a couple of friends, like my photographer friend James Start, came to visit him at least once a year in his pensioner's home in near Clermont-Ferrand, and you know, told me he was always following the Tour de France, always, you know, keen to discuss it. He was a great fan of Tadej Pogacar, and he probably died watching the tour. Well, he was 99 years old, you know. He lived, I mean, a man who gave himself to cycling with, you know, with so much enthusiasm, and a guy who gave himself to the party life and the good life the way he did, and lived 99 years. I don't have any advice to give you, or I don't think Jem would have given you any advice, but I mean, he lived his life as fully as you can, and it's a big loss for the Tour de France and for cycling. Okay, that was my little take on Raphaël Gemignani. See you guys.
L'étape de demain, le dîner d'hier. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's dinner.
Tomorrow's stage then, gents, in and out of Troyes, Champagne country. We've been talking about it as the gravel stage, or as Rolf Aldag put it to us earlier in the week, the gravel gamble, when we spoke to him. In fact, just on that, Red Bull Bora Hans Grohe have told us that Rolf will have something to say after tomorrow's race is over. So we look forward to that. But just to give you a quick pressy of tomorrow's stage, 14 gravel sectors. They begin after 47 kilometres. 8 of them are in hilly vineyards, and 6 sectors are packed into the final 30 kilometres, but those come on flatter roads. Tadej Pogacar was asked about it, the man still in the yellow jersey, just as a reminder there. He was asked about it in his press conference earlier, after today's stage. He said, tomorrow there is no favourite. Mitch, is there a favourite for you?
There's a few names have been throwing around, and you know, look, Wout van Aert, I think, still missing something from this race. Matthew Vanderpool, really, and that team's also needing it, but he's been a little bit quiet, not even a little bit quiet, very quiet. I've almost forgotten he's in this race.
Christoph Rodehaus, the boss at Alpecin, addressed that directly today, and he essentially admitted that Van der Poel hasn't got what they thought he would have. He's right. Not got the punch. He's not got the form.
Did he not train?
Probably not.
I'll just do it on the night.
Yeah. he's a Spanish training base. Maybe he's just been...
was a pretty big start of the year.
Yeah. That is.
So we think he's paying point. For that now.
And I mean, he's... We also, in comparison to the sort of... the singular rider that he is, you know, the sort of extraterrestrial, extra-dimensional character in the bunch.
I wonder about Matej Mohoric. Also hasn't really had much of a showing in this year's race, but a few riders sort of picked him out actually to me this morning as a kind of someone to watch.
Gravel world champ.
Gravel world champion as well. And
does he get to change his jersey sectors?
They were joking about this, that what he'd do is he'd have like a kind of some kind of base layer or zip, so that every time he got on a gravelled sector, he'd whip off the top layer, reveal the world championship
stripes.
Well,
they should definitely be allowed to do that.
It's a very sort of Superman-esque.
I don't know enough about clothing technology, but technology must exist to kind of have some kind of element designed into the jersey that would, like, you know, you press a button and it would, like, LEDs would light up or something with the rainbow stripes.
Maybe in Back to the Future too.
Yeah, it's a funny one, isn't it? We've been chatting about it with a number of people around the paddock, you know, kind of technical directors, mechanics, riders, sports directors, and it's a massive unknown. I think from a technical perspective, it's not quite as challenging as a cobbled stage. So they're thinking, well, you know, we'll run a couple of mil wider on the tyres. We might go from 28 to 30. But as far as equipment's concerned, nah, not really. It's probably closest to Strada Bianchi in the like what it's actually like to ride on, but even then I don't think it's particularly similar. The chat was that if it follows rain, which it has done today, I would expect it was raining up there as well as here, then it's going to be quite compacted. If it does dry out a lot, sun's just popped out shining on me, then it's going to be quite dusty. But it's a huge unknown, isn't it, what's going to happen.
It is. I was talking to Jenko Drost, the head of performance equipment at Visma Lisa Bike, earlier. He said they're not going to make too many changes. They will still be on the aero bike. He said it was very much an omloop setup for them. So wider tires than normal. Not as wide as Roubaix. Tire pressure, obviously, they will look at as well. But they're, in terms of how they're setting up the bikes, there's not too much that they're going to alter.
Well, your tire pressure is a big one. You know, you want to reduce that tire pressure for grip, but also for, you know, to reduce punches on the gravel. And as you said, yes, it will be more compacted from today. But with all the, you got to remember all the stuff, cars and stuff that goes over. Hundreds of cars before the stage are in front. So if we went out and rode it right now, it'd probably be glorious. But put 100 cars in the caravan and those tractors and all that crap that goes before the race.
Sorry, Mitch. Corrections corners over there, if you wouldn't mind, just
that's
go.
That's a fine. That's
200 French francs, please.
Why?
You're bringing the podcast into disrepute. No, they what they do is they do divert the caravan.
Oh, right, they are.
And the forward vehicles get diverted on a shortcut, so they don't actually go over the gravel. So we don't have, you know, Cochonou.
Okay, well that
sausages and whatever the hell else going over them, but
there still will be traffic in front, lead car, motorbikes.
So is it a gamble, as Rolf Aldag says?
Well, who did he mean a gamble for? Organisers?
Well, presumably for Primoz Roglic, for the riders who are perhaps not quite so comfortable on the gravel.
Well, does it come down to comfort, or does it just come down to that element of luck that becomes a much bigger player on stages like this, in the same way that it would do on a cobbled sector, where you could be the best prepared, the best position, but if you puncture from the lead group, well, you know, you might be a minute and a half, 2 minutes behind.
I mean, his point really was that a stage like this has got no place at the Tour de France.
Oh, I don't agree with that.
Was that what Richard Pluger said as well? I don't want to slander Richard Pluger and put words into his mouth, but if he didn't, then I've definitely heard it from other sports directors or team bosses as well, that this is not part of the tour. I don't know. I mean,
I think it's part of it. Same as a Roubaix stage. You know, it's like, you don't want a gravel stage every stage and gravel in every stage, but you know, this is just the route that they've got this year, and this is going to be the winner of the 2024 Tour de France. That's part of being the champion of this year's edition, be able to conquer what they've put in front of you.
And with,
I mean, let's think about like the way that the cycling industry is outside the Tour de France. Gravel has been enormous for years, and it's going to get more enormous. So, I mean, this isn't a proper gravel race like Unbound is, or, you know, the track or whatever. But it shows that the tour is kind of moving with the times. I mean, what are we going to stick with the sort of epic 280 kilometer mountain stages? Like we had in the 90s. Or
what about rewind back to the first paved roads? Were they avoiding them? Because there was paved roads and they always rode on gravel roads. We're not going to ride on paved roads. This race was always done on gravel roads.
Yeah. The tour does change, doesn't it? And
it has to move, has to evolve.
And you know, if you ask a sports director who might have been critical or doubtful about the place.
That means they're scared.
It does, maybe. But if their rider does well tomorrow, let's say Roglic is the one GC favourite that stays in a front group.
They'll be all pro gravel, won't they?
Yeah, more gravel. No, it was fine.
What a day. Can we have another stage tagged on the end, please?
Nah, all of that chatter about, it's a gamble and it has no place in the tour, that will completely disappear if their rider does well. So I think it does point to a fear, but it also a slight element of the unknown, isn't it? Most teams will have done the recon. Certain riders, Vingegaard being one of them, actually Mate Mohoric, also another one who... due to injury wasn't able to do the team recon for the stage. There's that sort of maybe control freakery is too strong a word, but the way the sport is now is, every little detail is analysed to the nth degree, isn't it? And this is one thing that they don't really know what's going to happen. There is no precedent. There's no sort of
watts per kilos on the climb.
Exactly. Yeah. And let's not forget, we are in the entertainment industry. This is an entertainment product.
Are you not entertained?
Exactly. That wasn't... Come on, you can do better than that. Russell Crowe.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to blow the... I don't want to be peaking on this.
Maybe we'll have Mitch out there tomorrow on the side of the road.
Your countryman, Russell Crowe.
On the final sector.
What accent does he speak in that?
As Maximus Decimus Meridius.
Are you not entertained?
There we go. Yeah.
Throw the sword up.
Yeah. It's like I was there.
Well, we look forward to seeing how tomorrow's gladiators get on. Boys, we're looking forward to it. We'll see you tomorrow.
Well, hang on.
Oh, dinner. Do you want a choice? A dinner. Oh, last night's dinner. I'm so sorry. Because it was a normal dinner for normal men.
In a slightly abnormal surround, wasn't it? We were in a square in Dijon. Again, we did the kind of, like we did in Italy, day in the break, followed by a day in the bunch. We played it a little bit more straight back, but with Japanese.
Yeah.
Which was excellent. Superb.
We're in this beautiful square in the middle of Dijon with the football on all sides of it.
Yeah, some little bombs going off on the side, wasn't there?
So we finished our meal, went out to watch the second half of...
That was disconcerting.
France, Portugal, when some loud bangs started going off. One was, the first one was a fair distance off, maybe, a street or so away. Second one a bit closer. Third one...
Very, very close indeed.
50 metres away for that.
What were they, the stunt grenades?
Well, either that or just a massive firecracker. Definitely saw like a little flash of light. And then Mitch, you thought you saw the culprit sort of weasel his way away.
Shifty.
And very, then we all looked shifty at each other and went, why are we still standing here?
So me and Mitch went and found an Irish bar, didn't we?
Yep, and we watched the end of that game.
Watched the end of a very dull game, but we watched it in amongst some really partisan French fan.
We should maybe... Can we mention today's lunch? If we're not breaking too much with the format.
It's a
meal what we ate in the past.
I need to be fined doubly because not only did I forget to mention last night's dinner, but today's lunch was superb.
Today's lunch. We were driving the off-course route from the start to the finish, which, as we mentioned yesterday, was D roads, off the motorway, just cruising through the middle of France, having a great old time. And we stopped in a little town called Châtillon-sur-Seine. Just beautiful, but in such a low-key way. Just could have been anywhere in France, really.
It's not a town that you'd necessarily go to someone, oh, I definitely have to go there. But if you're passing through, you'd say, yeah.
It was low-key beautiful. And on our way out, we saw that little picnic spot, didn't we? With a little waterfall and if it was in the UK,
unicorns and that.
If it was in the UK, there would be it would be absolutely packed. There'd be rubbish everywhere.
sounds lovely.
But it would sort of be, I don't know, unappreciated, a little bit unloved, and sort of disrespected. But in France, it's just a completely normal part of a normal town's landscape.
Well, the story was that we were looking for the boulangerie of our dreams, but it turned out that most of the Tour de France had found it before us, and so the cupboard was bare with regard to sandwiches. So we went for a little stroll, and we found a bakery, but also no sandwiches. We got some panic quiches, just in case, and then we thought, I'll get baguette. And then Mitch, you were like,
I think I spied a fromagerie on the way in.
A cheese shop.
Yeah.
And Mitch was proved right.
They had the roller door down.
I heroically let you go first in because I thought you might have the most success at getting them to open what was a very closed shop.
Just play on the whole tourist and brought my best Aussie accent out, and you buried the French deep down inside until the last minute.
Until I asked for the ticket, the receipt from the hotel. He was like,
but it was a really lovely stop, and we got a couple local cheeses. I got some Morbier. I can't remember the other names of the other two cheeses.
There was a Delice de Bourgogne, which was like a very rich, kind of spreadable, almost cream cheese. And then we had, actually, I've got the receipt in my pocket. I can tell you exactly what it was called.
An epois coupé?
Epois. It was an epois, wasn't it? Which I think had been left in some kind of wine or brandy or something to kind of colour the rind a little bit. It had quite a punch, that one, didn't it?
It certainly did, but it was the texture, taste, creamy, just... So a little bite on it as well. It was a beautiful cheese.
And the baguette was just... So we found our little picnic table in Châtillon-sur-Seine, got our cheese, got our bread. Mitch had his sharp Opinel knife from... Where were we? Stage 4. Saint-Jean-de-Maurienne and the Opinel knife factory. And I'd bought a little spreading knife from there between us. It was just brilliant. And nice to just kind of pop out of the tour bubble for 15 minutes before we jump back in the car and got on our way.
We had a mixture of a selection of sauces on sec as well.
We've still got some of them, haven't we?
Right. We should give this up then. We should give La Fromagerie du Coin a shout.
In Châtillon-sur-Seine, they will open their shop for you whenever you turn up.
Are we having a cheeky glass of plonk as well?
Yeah, it's at 2:30 in the afternoon. Just everything you want from a fromagerie.
Yeah.
So to them, merci. And to you both and to everyone listening, we'll see you tomorrow.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
You know what's the scariest part of October? Being vulnerable to cybercriminals. That's why this Cyber Scaries Month, you need Webroot Total Protection. With all-in-one protection for your devices, privacy, and identity, Webroot Total Protection helps defend every part of your digital life. Change your October from cyber scary to cyber secure with 60% off Webroot Total Protection at www.webroot.com/audio. That's 60% off for a limited time, but only when you go to www.webroot.com/audio.